Hello. And welcome to Shoftim. At last. So, yeah, Yehoshua took us 2 years and a month. I'm thinking Shoftim will be shorter, but, you know, you never know. First of all, thank you, Alina, again, for renewing your hosting.
Thank you for teaching.
I think I have everybody here on the email list for class. I think all of you are on it. Yeah, Judy is now on it. Yeah, so good. It's fine to start with Shoftim without having been here for Yehoshua. There are things that we saw in Yehoshua that are going to become relevant as we go through Shoftim. We'll even see some of it today, particularly in the realm of the geography that we studied. Whichever Tanakh you have, whichever version of Shoftim you have, they're all useful. I use the Dat Mikra. I find it to be very helpful. The Dat Mikra on Shoftim was by Dr. Yehuda Eli Tzur. This is the first time I'm going through a Sefer with his. I've seen they have Yehuda Kiel, and they have Amos Chacham, who have done a lot of them. But he does this one, and he, at least based on his introduction to the book, has a lot of background on history, a lot of background from archaeology, so that should be interesting as we go through it. There's another book that I'm using somewhat that I want to mention in case anyone is interested in it. It's called Bigdei Sheish. Rabbi Yosef Gabriel Bechhofer, who is a friend, and so I mentioned it because he's a friend, but also because it's a very interesting book, because, in particular when looking at Shoftim, and my reason for saying that is that one of the hallmarks of this book is the variety of judges and the backgrounds that they bring to this and the type of behavior they display over the course of this period of centuries. Incredible diversity among the Shoftim, so that you find some who are clearly warriors, some who are clearly not warriors. You find some who display behavior which, if it were done today, would probably earn the person ostracism from the community in one form or another. And you sort of look at it and say, well, are these role models or not? Yeah, same topic, right? In all seriousness, Rabbi Bechhofer takes the view, which I'm going to quote at one point on here, on the sheet. So Rabbi Bechhofer takes the view that if someone is presented in Tanakh as a shofet, as a judge, that person must be righteous. Has to be. And that's a hard view to follow through the book. And one of the things that I want to use it for is to see how can you interpret some of the things that the judges did in a positive light. Then you'll see, if you're not familiar with the book, don't worry, it'll come up soon enough in practice. But I wanted to give some background on this whole period of time and what we're talking about. And so today, as I said in the email, is mostly going to be introduction and background, but we're going to be seeing things from within Shoftim as well, not to worry. So first of all, chronology. If you think about the chronology that we have, the sort of traditional Jewish chronology by which we're in 5776, so Shoftim is from 2516 until about the year 2900, along those lines. When you try to match that up into the secular years that we're more familiar with, you run into trouble. And the reason you run into trouble is because this is before the missing 165 years. There's a gap of about 165 years between the general historical chronology and the traditional Jewish one. It comes up in the beginning of the Second Temple period, where historians, based on the way they place the Persian period, have a different chronology from ours. And it makes things a little bit messy. But basically, what it means is that if you follow the traditional Jewish chronology, which goes back to a body of Medrash called Seder Olam, this is between the 13th century before the Common Era and about the 9th century before the Common Era. Okay, that's what we would be talking about. Secular historians will move it about 160 years or so earlier than that, which means that they would put it at a long time ago. No, it means that they would put it at roughly 3,100 to 3,500 years ago, is what you'd be talking about. It's the beginning of the age known as Iron II, for those who follow that. In terms of what's going on in the era,
they carried on until the mid 9th century?
Before the Common Era.
Before the Common Era.
Before the Common Era, correct. The easy way to remember it is that not long ago there was a big celebration for Jerusalem 3000, which was supposed to be dated back to David HaMelech taking Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So when you consider that David is coronated by Shmuel, right, Samuel, and Shmuel is the last of the Shoftim, the last of the judges, so you know it ends a little more than 3,000 years ago by that chronology. So that may be a more helpful way to remember it than all of the numbers I'm giving you.
So this book spans 400 years?
Roughly. Doesn't look it, but yes. In terms of what's going on at that time in the area, so the Canaanites, we already know from Yehoshua, are not evicted by the Jews who come into the land. In fact, they are alive and well in much of the area, and so they're going to be a force. There are also tribes who live on the eastern side of the Yarden towards the south, not Jewish tribes. I'm not talking about ours. I'm talking about Midian, Moab, groups like that, Ammon. They're going to be a force as well. In the west, along the Mediterranean coast, you have who? Plishtim. So the Plishtim in the beginning of the period of the Judges aren't there that much, but there's this sudden influx about halfway through that we're going to come back to in a little bit to explain. But they dominate from a set of five cities. You know how you say a set of five cities? Pentapolis. Good word. Yes, and if not, we made it up. No, there's a Pentapolis. It's a five-city city-state, of which many of the cities are familiar to us today, right? Ashdod, Ashkelon, Ekron, Gat, and Aza. Thank you, Aza. So those are the five cities that that they develop. A nation that really isn't. Sorry?
And it's still getting us trouble.
Yeah. Nothing changes. That's the lesson of Sefer Shoftim right there. There are two other nations that are familiar to us in Tanakh that I'm going to mention, although they don't play a big role in the Sefer, and that is Mitzrayim, Egypt. They're pretty much in decline throughout. There were some incursions into Canaan sort of later, but not much. And Ashur, Assyria, which is in decline until the end of this period, and then they become dominant afterwards and become a big problem in the period of the kings. Until the midway point of the book, we're going to see wars between the Jews and the Canaanim, as well as their eastern neighbors, Moab, Midian, Amalek is going to be back. The Canaanim and the Easterners, generally speaking, only have temporary victories over the Jews, and the Jews come to triumph over them. The Canaanim are largely in decline. The Eastern tribes are basically opportunistic invaders. They're coming in to raid and to attack, and then they get driven back, and then they come in, and then they get driven back. However, after the midway point of the book, we get the Plishtim, and the Plishtim are there to stay. And they are experienced warriors, and again, we're going to talk more about the Plishtim as we go along. I'm throwing a lot of information at you, but hopefully it'll make sense once we actually see it in the book. You can look also on the outline I gave out. You see number one and number two. There are the chronology and the list of enemies. So hopefully that will help. In terms of who the Jews are in this period, what are we like at this point after the 28 years of Yehoshua? So one thing that we're not at this stage are warriors.
Nobody?
Basically. I mean,
even those ones from the east.
Right, the ones from the east who are known as warriors, we're going to find out. Maybe.
Not very good.
Well, no, like the tribe of Gad remains as warriors, but like Reuven, we're going to find out. No. But take a look for a second.
Conquering the land.
This is why we spent all those years and didn't succeed. If you take a look at Perek He, Pasuk Zayin, chapter 5, sentence 7, this is from the Song of Devorah, which hopefully you all memorized in school. Perek He, Pasuk Zayin, yeah, we had to memorize it. Yeah. Yes. How? As a matter of fact. Actually, I wonder if, yeah, no, it was. My Rebbe for Shoftim was the Talmud's grandfather. Yeah, he was my Rebbe for Shoftim. Okay, so if you take a look at chapter 5, sentence 7, this is when Devorah sings her song and she speaks of the way that the Jews had been under siege. And she says, at that time, Chadlu Prazon b'Yisrael. Prazon, which is a word, since Purim is coming, you'll also find in the Megillah, Areha Prazot, refers to open cities. As opposed to walled fortresses, they're open cities. So what she says is, at that time, because they were under attack, they stopped living in open cities. But what does that tell you they were doing until then? Open, vulnerable cities. These weren't warriors. They weren't building fortresses. They tended to be farmers and shepherds, which, you know, is consistent with our history until then. You know, minus a few centuries as slaves. Peirej Zion is actually the root of it. I wonder if it's not originally another Semitic language rather than Hebrew. Yeah, because it's not that popular a term. It actually, I'm going to go out on a limb with this and say it's probably associated with Peirej Tzadi, Lifrotz, which is to spread out and to be open. So I suspect that it's linked in that regard. Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, with his love for two-letter roots, would link them both as Peirej and show you other ones, Lifrok, to throw off, and so forth. Or Peirej Ayin, actually, Parua, which is also wild and fits with this too. So he probably does have something on that. So the Jews are not really warriors at this point. They don't do all that much to battle their neighbors and, you know, do what they were supposed to do when they came in. As we've discussed, we spent a lot of time in Yoshua talking about the whole ethnic cleansing discussion in the beginning of Yoshua and the what we were supposed to be doing and the morality of it and so forth. And I'd prefer not to reopen the can of worms, only to say that, as we've already seen in Yoshua, the Jews are brought there with a mission of evicting the Canaanim, meaning that much of Chumash is devoted to building up this image of Canaan as people who are not only idolatrous, but people who are immoral. They've created an immoral, abusive society. Shechem is one representation of that, where they kidnap and take Dina. Sodom is another example of that. Gerar is another example of that. And so the Jews are told, you're not coming into the land because you're wonderful and God wants to give you the land. You're coming in because you are God's weapon. Because he's tired of the Amori, he's tired of the Canaanite, he doesn't want them to exist as a society anymore. But they come in and they don't do the fighting that they're supposed to do, and they leave the Canaanim there, and much of this book is about the results of that. The Shvatim, the tribes themselves, tend to have more local identities than national. And we talked about this at the end of Yahushua. The fear that once you've scattered to the different corners of the land, you no longer see yourselves as part of a nation. Central authority is really, really difficult pre-internet, right? Frankly. But certainly, how are they going to see themselves as part of a nation? They don't communicate with each other. They live in their own areas. You know, how are they going to view themselves as being part of a nation is a problem, and it is exacerbated by leaving the Canaanim in place. Because what happens is, you have Jews living in, let's say, Dun, right? Dun, if you remember, has different areas. They're in the southwest along the shore, and then they're also northeast in Leshem, but we didn't get to Leshem yet. They're along the shoreline. So imagine that Dun manages to make deals with their local Canaanite or Plishti group, let's say. And they live among them. They trade with them. They may be working on their boats, going off to sea with them. At what point do you think perhaps they start to view their neighbors as more like them than, let's say, Menashe? Half of Menashe is living on the other side of the Yarden. Or even people who are living on that side of the Yarden, right? You go native. You start to view yourself as part of that population. And don't think that that's strange. Consider Europe, right? Well, consider it today. I wasn't even going to go to today. I was going to go to Europe in the period of the Enlightenment, when Napoleon says, I want to know if French Jews find themselves in a war against the British, and there are Jews on the other side, are they going to go to war against other Jews, or, you know, because you're defending France, or are they going to say, well, actually, they're our landsmen, they're our kinsmen on the other side, and therefore they'll refuse to go to war? And this is something that Jews faced down through the ages, and one wonders to what extent they felt that they were Canaanite, or kin of the Canaanite, more than they felt that they were kin of Jews elsewhere. So you find that, and that's a big concern in the book. The tribes east of the Yarden had a great fear at the end of Yahushua. What was their fear? Remember?
They'll be left out.
They'll be left out. I'm sorry?
Their children
right. Wouldn't
identify with the rest of the nation.
Right, or that others would not identify them. Right? Others would view them as some kind of weird Jewish tribe on the other side of the Yarden, but not part of the nation on the western side. And that comes true. They really do have a separate identity. The most glaring example of it is in Devorah's War, when she calls them and says, hey, will you help us against Kish, against the Canaanim, against Sisera, and they don't show up. But you also find it in the way they develop, and how I come back to Reuven on the eastern side of the Yarden. Reuven, and doubtless everyone who was here for Yahushua remembers this, the eastern side of the Yarden has Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh. The northern part is Manasseh. The central part is Gad. That's cheating, looking at the map.
It's visual reinforcement.
Got it.
I learned better that
I thought you drew it.
Thank you. Finally, after all those months, I have a map.
Yeah. So Gad is in the middle part, and then Reuven is supposed to be in the southern part. That's where Reuven is supposed to be. But in practice, that's not where they end up. That's not where they end up actually at all. If you take a look at your sheet, source number 3, this is from the Mesha Steel. The Mesha Steel is a stone, I think I'm going to guess the type of stone wrong, so I won't. But it was a stone tablet, huge, that was inscribed with records of military victories of the Moabites, Mesha being the king of Moab. And as you see, I put it on the sheet there, 850 before the Common Era, which, when you look at what I've given as our chronology, you realize that's towards the end of the period of the Shoftim. And he talks about the Jews. This is one of the examples of evidence of our presence in the area that's outside of our own text. And there's a whole story behind it. It was broken into 3 parts and whatever. But what I'm bringing here from it is number 3. And it says, and the men of Gad lived in the land of Atarot from ancient times. And the king of Israel built Atarot for himself, and I, Mesha, fought against the city and captured it. I know, Mesha sounds like a nice Yiddish name, doesn't it? But he's not nice, and he's going to show up in Shoftim, and we're not going to like him. But actually, not Shoftim, in Malachim. But the point that I bring this for here is to show you that God is living in Atarot, which is a problem. It's true that God built Atarot. If you were to look back in Bamidbar, Perek Lamed Bet, you would find that Shevet Gad, the tribe of Gad, built up Atarot. However, it's supposed to be in Reuven land, not in Gad land. Those who have the map can corroborate this. So that tells you that Reuven isn't there. And not only that, but the Mesha Steel says they'd always been there. Gad has been there from ancient times. Now, who knows what ancient times means to them? But that shouldn't have been. That's problem number 1. Here's an interesting problem number 2. If you go in Shoftim now, turn to chapter 3, sentence 13. Paragimel, Pasukimel. This is regarding Eglon, king of Moab. Okay? Eglon, king of Moab. Moab is southeast. It's on the eastern side of the Yarden, south. So we find, Vayesov Elavas b'nei Amon v'Amalek. He gathers together Amon and Amalek. Vayelech v'yaches Yisrael. He goes to war against Israel. Vayirushuas Ir HaTamarim. And they take Ir HaTamarim. Bonus points. Anybody remember what Ir HaTamarim is? Oh, that's cheating. No bonus points.
I thought.
Okay. No, you admitted it. That's fine.
Yeah, the translation.
What is it? It's Yericho. It's Jericho. Now, if you think of the way that he had to travel in order to get from Moab, south, on the eastern side of the Yarden, up to Yericho, you realize he has to cross through the land that should be Reuven's land. And there's no mention of Reuven there. There's no mention of him fighting anything, you know, along the way. So this leads...
No one there?
Well, that's the question, is so who is there? This leads Professor Elitzur, who was, I should explain a little bit about him. He passed away in 1997. He was professor of Tanakh at Bar Ilan, originally from Budapest, pre-war. But this leads him to conclude that Reuven isn't living where Reuven is supposed to live. So...
Didn't we say there was too
could
much
be
land
he went around.
To inhabit anyway?
Yeah. It's possible he went around, yeah. Sorry.
Didn't we say there was so much land that had too much land to inhabit anyway?
Correct. And maybe the answer is just that there were little pockets here and there. And if I just had his case that we just saw here, you could have said, like Diane said, he went around. You could have given some other explanation. You know, as Liba says, it's true. We saw that tribes had trouble holding their land because they weren't large enough for the land that they had in certain cases. So that's also a possibility. And the fact that God has atarot doesn't mean that Reuven is, you know, next door.
Reuven was a threat. Maybe they weren't.
Right. Maybe they were so assimilated.
Well, the key really, the key comes to us from Devorah. If you go back to Parakeh, back to chapter 5. Sentences 15 and 16. How does she describe Reuven? Right. Plagot Reuven. What are plagot Reuven? What are plagot? You can look at your translations.
Tribes.
Divisions. Right. Liflog is to divide. Right. Dor haflaga. Right. The generation of the dispersion. Right. The or hapalaga. The Plagot Reuven are groups of Reuven. In other words, she describes Reuven as living in scattered groups. But here is the kicker. I brought it on source number 4 on your sheets. I was trying to figure out what to include and what not to include. This one I had to include. Source number 4 from Divrei Hayamim, also known as Chronicles. Do any of you have sheets actually where that's not number 4? Because I edited the sheets after I sent them out. You do, yeah. I edited the sheets. Yeah. So what you have in Bamidbar is about God building up Atarot initially. Sorry. I afterwards I edited it and figured we're not going to get to the part I edited until later, but we did. No, this is the only one I have left. I'm going to email it out. I edited it. Figured it wasn't going to be a big deal, and I didn't want to make everybody crazy with another email.
Is it just number 5?
It's number 5 in the old one.
Yeah, no, it's there. It's just the numbers are wrong. That's all. Yeah. Okay. So, in number 4, or 5, in Divrei Hayamim, hello, the Uvela ben Azaz ben Shema ben Yoel hu yoshev ba'aroer ve'ad nevo u'bal me'on. The description here comes from the time of Shaul. Okay, so this is after the Shoftim, after the judges. But look what it says. Bela, son of Azaz, son of Shema, son of Yoel, lives in Aroer, which is a city on the eastern side of the Yarden, to Nevo and Baal Ma'on. Those are all cities on the eastern side of the Yarden. Bela Mizrah, and to the east. Oh, I should mention, he's talking about people from Reuven in this context. This is describing where Reuven lives. To the east, Yashava Levomid, Bara Lemin Hanahar Pras. They go to the east, up to the entrance to the wilderness from the Euphrates River. That's way east. Euphrates, Iraq, right? Way east. Why? Because they had a lot of cattle. It was too much for the land that they originally had in Gilad. And the point that I'm bringing you, which Elitzur points out, it's not my discovery, is that as you see as the section ends, Vayeshu be'ahaleihem al kol pnei mizrach leGilad. They dwelled in their tents across the land east of Gilad. That's where that's mizrach leGilad, east of Gilad. So what that means is Reuven isn't living close to everybody else. Whether it's because they don't want to fight with the Canaanim, or not Canaanim, it's the eastern side, Moab, whoever else is there, or whether it's because they have so much cattle that they live nomadically, because that's what shepherds do, right? We must have talked about at some point the antipathy in the Torah between shepherds and farmers, right? The shepherds and farmers hate each other. Why? because farmers are anchored and this is their land, and the shepherds wander around, consume the land, and then go somewhere else to consume that land. And their animals will invade the farmers' lands, and even if they don't invade, they're taking land that the farmers ultimately could cultivate and develop. Reuven, as this as the possessor of great flocks, just goes east. They're not where they were initially supposed to be. Gad, for their part, living in this area on the eastern side of the Yarden, doesn't really seem to view themselves as part of everybody else either. If you take a look again in Perek Hey, Pasuk Yud Zayin, chapter 5, sentence 17 in Shoftim, we're not going to do this much jumping around when we're actually in the book, but this is all introduction. But look at what she says when Devorah talks about who has come to help her and who has not. She begins the sentence by saying, Gilad be'ever ha'yardain shachain. Gilad lives on the eastern side of the Yarden. Meaning, and he didn't show up to help us in our war against Sisera. That's the idea. And in fact, you will see hints of that later in the book as well. So, in terms of the Jews who live on the eastern side of the Yarden, they have become exactly what they feared becoming. They are their own independent entity. Reuven is flowing off east into the desert. Gad, very comfortable where they are. We have to talk about what happens with Menashe in the north that I'm not ready for yet. In central Israel, west of the Yarden, Har Ephraim, Mount Ephraim, which we talked about at the end of Yoshua, has become a major center. Remember, that was where Yoshua lived, Timnath Cheres, but we said that's where Shechem is, which becomes a big center, and a city for Levium, and a city of refuge. Har Ephraim is the center of many events that are going to happen in Shoftim. The mountains up north are under our control early on in the book. That comes up in the fourth parak of Shoftim, when Devorah and Barak are getting ready for the war against Canaan. Barak succeeds in mustering, I think it's 10,000 troops, up in the mountains in the north, and nobody tells Canaan. Somehow Canaan doesn't find out, which tells you that that area was an area that the Jews had settled in, and that Canaan was not in. However, the low-lying areas, the valleys, are not conquered. And that's going to come up later in Yehoshua. The last section of the land I want to talk about is the Mediterranean coast. We talked about east of the Yarden. We talked about the central land, just in terms of the mountains versus the valleys. The area along the Mediterranean brings us back to the Plishtim. At the start of the book, the tribe Dan, that's supposed to be along the coast that we mentioned, that's supposed to be in the south, so they're having trouble. If you go back to Perek Aleph, chapter 1, sentence 34. So you find there, Vayelchatsu ha'emori es b'nei Dan ha'hara. The Emori push Dan to the mountains. Kilonis sanola redes la'emek. They don't let Dan descend into the valleys and into the areas by the sea. Dan is pushed off of the shoreline. However, go back now to chapter 5, sentence 17. I did give you all the references on the sheet. It says it's all listed there, so that may help. If you go back to chapter 5, sentence 17, we're told right after she talks about Gilad staying where they are, Vidan lama yagoraniyos. She says, why is Dan living off in his boats, meaning and not coming to war? But the point is, Dan is on the boats. Well, what do you mean? Devorah says Dan is on their boats.
No, I mean, how would Dan know if they're on their boats?
Oh, she sent messages. Yeah, we'll see that in chapter 4. She goes looking for help. She just doesn't find it. Yeah. The point is that between chapter 1, where the Amori are pushing them up into the mountains, and chapter 5, in the time of Devorah and Barak, they have somehow succeeded in getting to go to sea. Somehow that has worked out, whether by conquest or by, you know, some kind of covenant with their neighbors. How much time has elapsed in between? Take a look at the flip side of your sheet. I gave you this table of the judges. For some of it, I had to draw it up Arbanel because it wasn't explicit in the Pesukim, but a lot of this is explicit in the book itself. But your first Shofet reigns for 40 years. We're in the last source. The first Shofet, Adniel ben Kenaz, is there for 40 years. Then Ehud ben Gera for 80 years. Shamgar ben Anath is just the last year of Ehud's time, and then Devarah. So there are 120 years between the beginning of the book and chapter 5. So there's a significant chunk of time going on, but over that period, however many generations that is in their day, you're seeing some success along the coast. Dan is successful.
Do we know what the lifespan of people were during this time period?
So we don't.
They lived like 180 years.
We're not told so-and-so was X number of years old when he died. This book is much more focused on the community than the individual. It's known that infant mortality was much higher, and people died in war, and people died of famine, and so forth, and that would, you know, people would die younger for that reason. There's a myth that's out there that if you go back further in time, people didn't live to the ages that they live today, the 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever it is, that people didn't live that long. But it's a misunderstanding. The average age of death was younger, the average lifespan was shorter, because it was weighted towards people dying in youth, whether they didn't survive childhood or whether childbirth or whether war or whatever it was, that weighs it down. But it isn't that nobody could live longer, it's just that the average becomes skewed. So, but I don't know like what's considered normal at that stage. I don't think you get really strong indications from the book. The other one I wanted to show you in terms of change, and I gave you the references there and on the sheet as well, is Asher. Right? Asher was supposed to live where? Right, Asher and Naphtali are in the north, Asher towards the coast. Right? That was our discussion about whether Zebulun is up the coastline or not up the coastline. For those who hated the geography part of Yehoshua, I apologize. And now that I understand it, I like it. But in the beginning of the book, in chapter 1, sentences 31 and 32, you find regarding Asher, it says, Asher lo horish es Yoshvei Akko ves Yoshvei Tzidon. Asher did not succeed in taking that land. Akko, we know Akko to be a major port, right? And Tzidon, which is up towards Lebanon, and Achlev and Achziv and so on, Asher doesn't succeed in getting to the shoreline. But once again, we go back to Devorah's statement in chapter 5. A lot of our history is relying on Devorah to be accurate. But in chapter 5, sentence 17, it says, Asher Yashav Lechof Yamim. Asher lives by the shore of seas. So again, there's been a shift. It seems like in the beginning of the book, the Jews are gaining ground along the shore, whether because they're making peace with the Canaanim and the Phoenicians, whoever it is that's along the coast, or whether it's because they've succeeded in conquering them, I can't say. Professor Elitzur thinks it's because they made peace with the Canaanim and the Phoenicians and so forth, and that's why they didn't want to go to war to help Devorah, because they don't want to mess things up with their local treaties. That's one possible explanation. But that's the beginning of the book. And what happens midway through is the Plishtim change everything. And the Plishtim are going to be dominant until well into the period of the kings, right? David has trouble with the Plishtim throughout his reign. So who are the Philistines? Who are the Plishtim? Anybody know where they come from?
Greece.
Right. The area of it's really the Aegean Sea, right? The Plishtim are assumed to come from the island of Crete. If you can picture at all the Mediterranean coast, right, as you go up from Israel, right, so you have Lebanon up there, and then you have Turkey, and the coast curves, right, to go west. So you have there is sort of, its technical word for it is an embayment, where the water goes in and forms a bay between Turkey and Greece, and that embayment is called the Aegean Sea. I sound really good saying this because I prepped for this. Ask me in a week, forget it. But the point is that area, those coasts, that's the area that is populated by what become known as the Sea Peoples. There are groups of invaders from there for a very long time, going back to the times of the Chumash. Right? When we talk about Plishtim and the Chumash, we're talking about Sea Peoples who had already come earlier, and the major Plishti force comes in during the period of the Shoftim, because what happens is there are invaders in Greece, who are the ancestors of what then becomes the Greece that we know of, and they drive the Plishtim out there. So they take to the sea, they come down the coast, and they come into Israel and occupy the land along the shore. And they have an advantage, because we weren't warriors, but they were. They had always survived as raiding sailors. So they are organized, they conquer the Canaanite cities, and then they use the Canaanite cities that they conquer as a base to attack everything else. Which means that Jews who had made peace with the Canaanim are suddenly out of luck. Mm-hmm. Right? You made peace with Canaan, and you were happy when Canaan controlled their cities. Their cities are under new ownership. And the new owners are not interested in continuing these treaties. And so now suddenly the Plishtim are among us, and that creates havoc in the second half of the book, really after Perek Yud. Dan, for example, is forced out. Take a quick look at Shoftim Perek Yud Gimel, chapter 13, sentence 25. This is the beginning of Shimshon's story, right? So Shimshon is among Dan. And what is Shimshon's main job as the warrior from Dan? To go place to place fighting the Plishtim, right? That's Shimshon's job. If you jump to chapter 16, sentence 5. No, I'm not sure why I wanted 16:5. That's not what I wanted. I wanted something else. But the point is that the Jews come under the control of the Plishtim. What we will see, I'll show you that, in chapter 15, sentence 11. I must have written down wrong what I wanted there. But in 15:11, you find that Yehuda sends 3,000 men, and they tell Shimshon, "Don't you know that the Plishtim are controlling us?" Now remember where Yehuda is. Yehuda's in the south. They're not on the shore. The Plishtim, by the days of Shimshon, have already spread to the point where they're causing trouble in Yehuda. And not only that, but when you get to Shmuel, you find them among Binyamin, and eventually the rest of Israel. So what this means is, and this is the end of the geography, so you know, for those who aren't into it, yeah, you've survived. But what it means is that you have, on the eastern side of the Yarden, Jewish tribes who are not necessarily even staying where they originally were supposed to be, and who are not coming to fight on behalf of the people on the western side of the Yarden. Central Israel, you have Jews controlling mountainous areas, but not the lowlands and the valleys. And then along the coast, a growth of success initially, Dan, Asher succeeding initially, but once the Plishtim come sweeping down out of Greece, they get shoved off of the shore and they come under the control of the Plishtim, who slowly spread through the land. Clear? That's the basic geography of it. If you didn't get it, that's okay, but I felt like it's sort of responsible to present that at the introduction.
And Plishtim in English we know as Phoenicians.
Philistines. So Phoenicians don't have a name that I can think of as that original. I mean, today we just take Phoenician and we Hebraicize it in order to get it. But I don't believe that we have an ancient word for them. It could be wrong, but I don't think so.
I'm telling you, it was on it.
Yeah. Okay. The other populations do. I mean, I think the Phoenicians of it Sidonim. In fact, because Sidon is their capital.
Didn't they appear?
Oh no, they appear. They're just not called Phoenicians. And Sidonim, I think, is the term for the Phoenicians, because that's where they were. Yeah. If you take a look on your sheet under the heading of the book, which on the sheets that I gave out is number 6, on the others it'll be a different number. Just a quick quote from a quick quote from the Gemara in Bava Basra. Since we're going to talk about the book itself, we should know who's credited with writing it. So the Gemara credits Shmuel with writing Sefer Shoftim. It's not written bit by bit by the Shoftim all along, but rather Shmuel is the one who writes this book as well as his own book, meaning Shmuel. And he also writes Rus, because Rus also takes place during this period, right? With the opening line in Megillas Rus. Exactly. And it was in the days of the judging of the judges. So that's during this period of time. So Shmuel is credited with writing it, and we'll see that he plays a little bit with the history within the book in order to teach important lessons. There are three sections to the book. The first section of it is the opening chapter and a couple of psukim, and that is a history of the settlement of this land. It will cover the settlement up to the time of Devorah, and then afterwards it's going to go back to the Shoftim who were before her. And we'll see that we'll see that fairly clearly as we go through it. The Jews of this time failed to conquer the land. It is considered to be a failure of will, not a failure of means. There's a very interesting contrast. If you take a look at Shoftim, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Chav Zayin, chapter 1, sentence 27. It says, V'lo Horish Menashe, chapter 1, sentence 27. V'lo Horish Menashe es Beit Sha'an ves Benoseha. Menashe did not conquer Beit Sha'an and its surrounding villages and Tanakh and all those other ones, right? For those who have a Tanakh, go look at Yehoshua, chapter 7, sentence 12. And read that out. Someone read that out, please. Yehoshua, chapter 7, sentence 12. Those of us who don't have a Tanakh with us, keep an eye on what you have in front of you. It's going to sound very similar with one word that's different. Exactly. B said it. Velo. Velo Yachlu. B'nei Yisrael Lachum, etc. They weren't able. Correct. They weren't able to conquer, was what it said in Yehoshua. Here it says, they just didn't do it. Yeah, they said, we don't want to. This is not our life. This is not what we want to be. Yes. So that's the opening section, and it concludes in the beginning of the second chapter with punishment, prediction that punishment is coming because you made deals with Canaan instead of doing what you were supposed to do. That's the opening section of the book. The second section is the dominant section of the book, and that's chapters 2 through 16, and it's the history of the Shoftim, from Yehoshua's death until Shimshon's death. And it's the standard rinse and repeat cycle that goes on in this section. The Jews do what God told them not to do. They fall to their enemies due to the influence of their neighbors. Then they pray to God, and God sends somebody to save them. Rinse and repeat. There are two sections in this, one pre-Plishtim and the other post-Plishtim, as we'll see. The third section is the odd one. The one that I noted on your sheet as simply the two calamities. Anybody know what the two calamities are? What are we talking about? Pelegish Begiva is one, and the other is Hazal Micha. Those two stories demonstrate how the Jews have deteriorated, how they've stopped being the special nation they were supposed to be. Pesel Micha, you find the corruption of service of God. Elements of service of God are surrounded in idol instead. And then the other one, Pidagish Begiva, is this horrible story of rape and then what follows from it as a civil war among the tribes. We've stopped being any Jewish people you could possibly recognize by that stage of the book. But those two events didn't happen at the end of Shoftim. Those two events occur much earlier within the book. As a matter of fact, some even assume they're from the beginning of the period. One reason, those who were here for Yehoshua will remember that when we had this mess where the two and a half tribes were going east and then he built the Mizbeach, who was it who was called upon to mediate between them? Pinchas, right? Pinchas is called upon to mediate. And at that point, I think it was Ruth who asked, but it was someone sitting over there who asked, asked the question of... I saw Nanette sitting over there and said, oh, I'm in trouble today. No, it was either Ruth... I think it was Ruth who asked the question. Pinchas is still around at this point. Pinchas is still... What is Pinchas doing here at this stage? And we talked about the question of at what point Pinchas, when he was born and so forth. So he's going to be involved in the story of Pelegish Begiva also. So that leads some to think, well, it must be from the beginning of the book, because how long did he live? But at the same time, who knows? He's Pinchas. But the point is that these are put at the end of the book, not because chronologically they're at the end, but because before we're going to see Shmuel, and we're going to see the desire to have a king, and we're going to see the appointment of Shaul and David and the general elevation of the Jews, that shows the depths to which they fell as a result of their connection to Canaan around them. And that's why I brought you this on your sheet. If you take a look at number either 8 or 10 on your sheet, the psukim from Bereshit. Right? Bereshit 17, 7 to 8. So Elitzur points this out, that what you see effectively in the three sections of the book is the reversal of what God said to Abraham. Hashem says to Abraham, I underlined the key parts in the English. I didn't do it in the Hebrew because then you couldn't read the vowels. But he says to him, Bakimosias brisi beinu uveinecha. I'm going to establish my covenant between myself and you, uvein zaracha acharecha, your children after you, ledorosam, for all the generations, lebris olam, an eternal covenant, leyos lechal elokim lezaracha acharecha, to be God for you and for your children after you, v'nasati lechal zaracha acharecha, es eretz megurecha, and I have given to you and to your children after you, the land in which you dwell, the land of your residence, is kol eretz Canaan, the entire land of Canaan, l'achuzas olam, as an eternal portion. Va'isi lahem l'elokim, and I will be their God. So Elitzur says, first they fail to settle the land that's been given to them. That's section 1, where it talks about them not conquering. That results in a failure of liyos l'chal elokim, to be your God. And that's what we see happening in section 2 as they follow Avodah Zarah. And then ultimately they lose their identity as this special nation altogether. And the whole covenant between Hashem and them, and that falls apart as demonstrated at the end of the book. The main message that this book is giving is a national message. And it's a message that God is moving your history. The events that happen in your lives should not be interpreted, and not in your life, but in the life of the nation, should not be interpreted as random or the result of natural causes. You know, the Plishtim invaded because they were driven out of Greece, but rather God is moving things along. And if you're not going to do what you're supposed to do, then God is going to do it to you. That's the message that this book is giving, so that each event begins with the Jews doing what is bad in God's eyes and being sold, as the Navi puts it, to their neighbors over and over again. If you take a look at, just to give one example, Perek Gimel, chapter 3, and you want Pasuk Zion, sentence 7. Vayasu b'nei Yisrael es hara b'nei Hashem. The Jews did that which was bad in the eyes of God. Vayishkechu es Hashem elokeihem. They forgot God, their God. And they served the Baal. And so what does God do in sentence 8? He gets angry, or displays anger, and he sells them to Kushan Rishatayim, the king of Aram Naharayim, and so forth. That's one example, but we're going to see it repeatedly within the book. How do you get rescued? God sends an emissary to rescue you when you call out to God. If you look at just, you know, sentences later, sentence 9, Vayizaku b'nei Yisrael el Hashem, the Jews cried out to God, Vayakem Hashem Moshia l'bnei Yisrael vayoshiim, and God set up a rescuer for them, and he saved them. Who was it? Asniel ben Knaz, and so forth, and he is picked by God, and he leads the Jews.
Is each rescuer a shofet?
So it appears. That's actually our next topic. So, as always, or as good with the segue, we're going to have to come back to that. There's only one place in this book, Elitzur points this out, there's only one place in this book where we're going to be introduced to the perspective of Canaan. And that is going to be, at one point, Ammon is going to say, the nation of Ammon, they're going to say, you know, we're fighting you because you took our land. Which, you know, you'd think, you know, at some point someone should have mentioned. But only there is it mentioned, and even there, it's only mentioned as a way to explain how it is that the Jews came to possess the land of Ammon. Because you weren't supposed to go to war with Ammon. And the answer is, because Canaan took the land of Ammon, and then the Jews beat back the Canaanim and got the cities. So their perspective is only mentioned in order to say, actually, we didn't do that. We did what we were supposed to do. We went to war with Canaan. We never went to war with Ammon. Why is that never mentioned? Why don't we ever mention the perspective of Canaan? not because it's not their book. There's a reason for it. There's a reason why it's not mentioned. Because
Why would we? We're talking about what happened to us, what we did.
Yes, but more than that, it's because this is all God-driven. In other words, this book is not about what, you know, the natural causes and lives of the events that are, of the nations that are around us. When we get raided from the east, right? I mentioned it with the Christian, but it's true for the Easterners also. When we get raided from the east, it's because there was a famine or something going on to the east, and they needed to plunder something, and so they came to attack us. But it's never going to say that. It's never going to say there was a famine in the east and Moab came. It's just going to say the Jews didn't follow God. They strayed. Therefore, God sent Moab to attack them. It's not going to mention any of the manipulations. It's sort of the anti-Megillas Esther, in a sense. Right? The book of Esther gives us all the natural causes and doesn't talk about what God did in order to move things forward. It doesn't say, you know, God made Ahasuerus get angry at Vashti. It says Vashti refused to come to the party and therefore Ahasuerus got angry. Right? It's the exact opposite. It's hiding the divine role behind that which he set in motion. Whereas here, it's hiding all the events that God sets in motion in favor of saying, God did this. Essentially, I like that. Okay. You can't deny, though, that there is a personal message here, too. Because if you're going to say that the nation has to understand that God is behind the events of their lives, you also have to say that individual Jews are supposed to draw this in some level also. Now, that's controversial. Meaning you have someone like Ralbag, who says, or Rambam, who says that God doesn't necessarily watch the events of your life closely. Only if you are on a high spiritual level does God watch the events of your life closely. But take a look at what Ralbag writes here in source number 9. Remember Ralbag's style. We've seen it before. Ralbag, in his commentary, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, we're talking about 14th century, I believe. His style is that he's a rationalist. He likes to translate words. And then at the end of each section of the book, he gives you morals and lessons you can learn from the preceding sections. Sometimes those are religious lessons, and sometimes they're practical lessons, right? We saw at the end of Yehoshua, he made a comment about being buried with one's family, because Yehoshua is buried in... Oh, because Elazar and Pinchas are buried in their family plots. So here, Ralbag says, Harishon, the first lesson to draw from the beginning of the book, Hu kolel kol sipur zeh sefer. It actually includes this entire book's narrative, everything you're going to see in the book of Judges, the book of Shoftim. V'hu shem mi sheyavod Hashem yizbarach u'mushgach v'ne'ezar bo. The lesson is that one who serves God will be washed over and aided by God. V'asher yasur mimenu, someone who strays from God. Tasur ha'hashgacha ha'elokiyut. It should probably be Elokit. God's supervision will stray from him. And then he'll be prepared for any ill to happen to him, meaning bad things will befall him because God isn't going to protect him. He said, you see it in the narrative, because whenever we stray, something bad happens. You come back to God, good things happen. So he says it's meant to be a personal message as well. So what we've seen, to make sure that we know what, you know, where we've been, is we have a sense now sort of when this is happening, a little more than 3,000 years ago. We know that the Jews of this time have not become what they were supposed to become when they entered the land. East of the Yarden, not really identifying with everybody else, not necessarily living where they're supposed to live. Central land, they have sort of this detente where they have the upper parts and the lower parts with the Canaanim. By the shoreline, more success, doomed perhaps when the Plishtim come. We understand now that the book has itself three sections. One, reviewing where they are settlement-wise. One, with the history of the Shoftim. And then two stories at the end. The idol of Micha and the story of the concubine of Giva, Pilegish Begiva. And what we're seeing is that the central message is God is supposed to be the one moving your history, which may have a personal message for people's lives as well. So far, so good? Okay. Then let's take a look at the question. Now, we only have a couple of minutes, but at least we'll start on this. The there's one quote I did bring it in here. Take a look at number 13, because it might as well jump to it. It's not on the sheets that I emailed out. This is one of the things that I added.
Okay.
I took out the earlier sources to make room for this. Rabbi Bechaper has a line from the beginning of his introduction to Shoftim. He says, "Ein lecha sefer b'tanach hamivatei choser hatzlacha k'sefer Shoftim." No book in Tanakh expresses failure like the book of Shoftim. Yeah, this is it. I said, when we were talking about learning it, I said it's a depressing book. Sorry? Yeah, no, that's true. The alternatives weren't necessarily better. But this is, in a sense, this is the Koheles of the nation. In that sense, like Koheles is like the depression of the individual going around and around and not getting anywhere. So this is pretty much where the nation is. This is just a tough time for the Jews, and it's really tough to be a shofet. So the question is, who are the shoftim? And there are two schools of thought, which I'm going to try to track through the book as much as I can. There's one school of thought that says the shoftim were wonderful, like I said from Rabbi Bechaper in the beginning. So there's one school of thought that says the Shoftim are wonderful. If they appear in Tanakh as a leader, they must be great. And so everything that we see them do, we're going to have to interpret in that light. The other school of thought is the approach that says, I'm looking at the text that's in front of me, and the text that's in front of me doesn't make them look wonderful. And so reads it in that light as a range of leaders with a range of powers. And the common denominator is just that they rescue Jews from their enemies. And if they do, then they get the title Shofet. Now, literally, Shofet means what?
Judge.
A judge. So the question is, are they actually judges? Did they spend time judging?
Like, yeah. For their time, they're great.
Right.
So it doesn't make them great, but not like...
Right.
I think it might be good if God is the one
like
sending
good.
Them to the Jews. You would
like
think
they're good,
the
but not compared to maybe others.
Right. So there's a big challenge with this question that you're asking. It's a good question, and maybe we'll start with that question next time to flesh out a little bit further. But there's a difference between with Noah and with the Shoftim. And the difference is that here we have their track record. Meaning with Noah, all we have is, it says he was righteous in his generations, and then we have to figure out what that means, and there's one view in the Medrash that says for his time he was good, and you know, all sorts of ways to read that. And then we can infer things like, well, we don't see him going out to reach out to people, so therefore maybe he didn't go out to reach out to people. We're going to get like the story of Shimshon, who goes off to try to marry or not marry Plishti women, right? And not just once. We're going to get Avimelech, who killed his brothers, right? And he's a shofet. And Yiftach, and his own nightmare. So, like, we're going to have stories that just, you look at it and say, it's not so easy for me to say, in any time this would have been righteous. So this is going to be a big challenge, but we're going to go through the different schools of thought, and I guess that's what we'll pick up with next time, is the question of what is a shofet. We'll see the outline that I gave you on the sheet for who they were, when they lived, where they're described within the book, and then we'll start on Shoftim itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you.